tracking the horizon. And I'll check my machine. I'm sure to be that cold. It's gonna happen soon, soon, or so very soon. It's just the times of leap, and you say, be still, my love. Open up your heart, let the light shine in.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Crossing the Line. You're on Eastside Radio 89.7. My name is Paul, and I'm here with Alex today. Alex and I are going to be running this interview. GT's not here. How have you been, Alex? Thank you.
How's it going?
Very good, thanks. And we've got some great guests in today. I can't wait to hear their stories.
Yeah, me too.
We have the Joneses in today. There's Lauren and Justin Jones, who are, I could only say, intrepid adventurers. And they'll be telling us all about their journeys. The last one was actually the most interesting. Travelling across Australia, 1,800 kilometres across Australia with a one-year-old daughter. Wow, that is a story in itself. Anyway, they've also chosen several music choices for us as well. And we might get into their first choice of music before we get to speak to Justin and Lauren Jones. So starting off with the Chemical Brothers and Go.
Can't breathe. Everybody jumping out of their mind. Everybody going out of their skins. Everybody jumping out of their mind. Everybody going out of their skins.
Rugby Club, Australia's first gay rugby club, and Vice President of ACON. And you're listening to Crossing the Line on Eastside FM.
Yes, you're back with us here on Crossing the Line, and we have our guests in the studio, Lauren and Justin, and also we've been joined by our other host, Rupert. Hey, Rupert, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks, nice to be back.
It's
a bit late.
Okay. Welcome, Lauren and Justin Jones, to Crossing the Line today.
Thanks so much for having us.
So Lauren and Justin are close to completing a documentary of their 1,800-kilometre journey across the outback with their one-year-old, Morgan. That adventure is a bit of a first for you, Lauren, but it's nothing new, or adventure is not new for you, Justin. Can you tell me a little bit about what brought you to this?
For sure. I've been pretty lucky over the past, I suppose, 15 years now to have made adventure my life and my career. I mean, if you looked at me back in year 12 at school, I was probably the least adventurous person you could probably imagine. I was that fat, awkward kid at school that just followed direction from other people and really fell into adventure post school. And so I was lucky enough to partner up with a couple of mates from school and do a trip down the entire length of the Murray River, 2,500 kilometres over 49 days. And this was a real sort of Huckleberry sort of Finn-style adventure that kind of really pushed me down my path a little bit. But, you know, I didn't really think that was a viable career, so I went off, studied science. And then I realised I was living someone else's life, and I had a pretty big knee-jerk reaction to that and decided to paddle a kayak from Australia to New Zealand. So not your normal, I suppose, response to a career path that you probably weren't enjoying. But so I worked on this project for about 3.5 years, and then along with a mate, James Castrician, paddled a kayak from Australia to New Zealand. That was 3,300 kilometres over 62 days. Followed up with another trip down in Antarctica, skiing from the coast of Antarctica to the South Pole and back, and I really just fell into this. I didn't know this was a thing you could actually do. There was no career guidance counselors that said, "Hey, you can be an adventurer." I mean, it sounds like a joke actually to say I'm a professional adventurer. So I've fallen into this, and I do a lot of corporate speaking as well, make the odd documentary. And when I got back from Antarctica, I started planning another journey. I started planning a trip right across Australia, trying to live, hunt and gather across the land, walking on my own feet and off track. And it's all its twists and turns. I met Lauren over here, fell in love. We got married fairly quickly. And we decided to start, you know, a family, which is an even bigger adventure. And I started losing some psych for this idea of doing a big solo trip by myself. And it was actually Lauren who actually saved me a bit from that and said, "Well, I can see that you want to do this journey, so why don't we go as a family?" And I thought, I've married the right woman.
So Lauren, where did you come into the frame then? I mean, Justin's been doing several adventures. Did you sort of come in after the kayak trip across to New Zealand, or...?
I met Justin probably, 3 months after you got back from Antarctica?
Yeah, I was still bit of a broken man, I think.
So we met, and I always knew this was in him and loved that about him. I think that the unconventionality was really intriguing to me because I had been kind of surrounded by very maybe more A-type typical people. I spent more time climbing the corporate ladder than any mountains, which I did love. But at the point after having our daughter, and I had been in business for 15 years and kind of followed a very linear path. And I'm American, and I think there was always this, you know, get good grades, go to university, get a good job, climb the ladder, and you'll be happy. And you kind of realized, like, climbing this ladder, and one foot led to the other, and I kind of felt really boxed in. And then we had Morgan and Justin and I. It was a first date night, probably too much wine, but we kind of started
way too much sleep deprivation as well.
Yeah. And we kind of just said, what do we want out of our life? And are we living by our terms? And I was happy for him to go. He was originally planning a cross Australia trip. So our trip was on foot in the end, and he was going to do it on foot, but he was going to hunt and gather across kind of like John Muir. He had done all these trips outside of Australia, but wanted to do something inside. And I had been very, I don't know, I knew I meant married an adventure, didn't know that that was a thing when I met him either, but I wanted him to do it. But I think when you have a child, that adventure would have seen him not only miss his life at home, but her first words, her first steps. I was also struggling, you know, how do I be a corporate person and how do I be a mom, and kind of where do those two things intersect? And so we just said, well, why don't we just do something totally different, off grid, disconnected, and kind of take some time out and do something really different.
I mean, they are quite incongruous. I mean, for me, from my perspective, you don't normally get, you know, adventure mixing with family too well. It's a bit of a random fact, but it's more anecdotal than anything. There's a high rate of divorce in adventure. It's very solo, very selfish. And if you continue down that path, you know, you can't help not but grow away from the people that are close around you because they're not on that journey and path with you. They don't have those seminal moments. So when Lauren turned around and said that, and we started embarking on trying to do this journey together, it was an amazing, forged by fire, I think, in some way, shape or form. But we've got these shared experiences that we'll never, you know, never regret and never be able to take back. Amazing.
Was it a quick, easy decision, though, for you to begin with, Justin? Because after your previous adventures, particularly at Antarctica, you're used to the isolation. You just made mention of that fact. You sort of get drawn by the isolation and sort of self-discovery. And then now Lauren's going to come along. Did you have to sort of wrestle at all with the idea of...
It was less, I think, that Lauren was coming along, but we were going together. And the amazing thing, I think, that the self-discovery was actually seeing the way that Morgan, our daughter, because she was 15 months when we started on this journey, to see her grow. She only took her first steps a week before we went into the outback. And to see her grow as a human being to this fully capable, like, creature by the end of it was utterly amazing. Mm. So I can't think about actually going back in time and not going with them now.
I was interested what you were saying about the trek. It wasn't just a walk. It was living off the land. Is that right?
That was originally what I was planning, yeah. So when we made the decision that Morgan and Lauren were going to come along, then the risk factors on certain aspects were too high. So what we did is rather than going right across Australia, so how do we mitigate that? Rather than going right across Australia, we did half. Mm-hmm. And instead of going completely off track, we stuck to sort of more form tracks, four-wheel drive tracks and that sort of thing. And only certain patches went off track. And we didn't want to have to rely on sort of, I suppose, just hunted and gathered food. I just think that was a bridge too far with Morgan and Lauren. I think if it was just myself, I was happy to put myself through that. I think suffering it would have been because I'm probably not the best hunter in the world or gatherer, but it would have got by if it was by myself, I think.
I was going to say, when you're hunting, or have you done hunting and gathering before?
Yeah, I've been learning Antarctica. No, not so much, because in the interior there's nothing there. Mm-hmm. On the Tasman journey, we try to be self-sustained with all the stuff that we had with us. We could have fished along the way, but just being wet 24/7 for 62 days straight, you actually have really soft hands. So even just handling a fish, there's a highly likelihood that you're going to get cut. Mm-hmm. And those things turn into infections and you actually don't recover. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I've done a lot of study and research and practical application sort of post those trips, you know, for periods of time, but nothing like 2-3 months. Mm.
So your future plans involve like a version of an Australian Bear Grylls?
Oh, yeah, the camera crew and everything. There we go. I mean, Bear Grylls' cameraman's pretty bloody good. I mean, he's doing everything but backwards.
Yeah.
Because he's got that camera on it. I think we're going to sort of... I think there are going to be some solo trips, but they're going to be smaller and shorter, and they're not going to have the same level of risk that I was willing to accept as a single man. Now, it's more about shared experiences with Lauren and Morgan and wanting to share that with my family and the people that are most important to me.
We'll get to. I'm really interested if you have like a few memories of some really, really strong moments that you had together. But before we go into it, we might have your next song. I don't know whose song is next, but if you'd like to introduce it, who?
It's Dancing Queen by ABBA. Okay. And this is actually Morgan's choice. This is Morgan's favourite track, our daughter.
She's two, and we play this record at home, and she always asks for ABBA.
Yeah, it's awesome. So if she was in here, she would be boogieing like crazy right now.
I think she's a 70s reincarnation.
I used to ask for ABBA when I was young. I don't now, though, but anyway.
Let's hit it.
And I'm an Australian representative in modern pentathlon, and you're listening to Crossing the Line on Eastside Radio.
And that was Dancing Queen by ABBA, young Morgan's favourite track. So I'm interested, I know that it would have been, I mean, how long, 102 days, I think you told me the whole trip took. Can you talk us through a bit of the route and some of the setup?
We started off in Docker River, actually, which is roughly the centre of Australia. If you could look at where Uluru is, 200 kilometres further west, so close to the borders of WA, NT and South Australia. And then we kind of arced our way in a big sort of like, down towards Port Augusta, sort of passing down Udnadatta, Apatula Fink, Maori, Parachilna, and then marched into the ocean at Port Augusta. The setups we had, we both pulled a cart each. My cart was this sort of homemade. I made it with a mate of mine. This giant cart that actually was able to drag up to about 270 kilos worth of food, water supplies, our camping equipment. But arguably, though, Lauren had the harder load, I should say.
More demanding.
That's a better one. Yeah, more demanding load. A daughter, and she was pulling behind her a modified bike trailer, a Burley bike trailer. And that was weighed up to about sort of 70 to 90 kilos, depending on what leg, and had all the things that Morgan would kind of need, one, to keep her safe, alive, and also entertain her.
Yeah.
And how hard was that?
To entertain her?
Mm.
It was a really interesting one because, you know, as a mom, you worry that you're screwing him up permanently if you do anything outside of the ordinary, probably, or you worry that anyways. But when we first started, she had just literally learned to walk in the city a week before. And so most kids that are walking are in their, you know, carpeted nurseries or in their house. But here she is in the middle of the outback, and thorns could go through tires, like car tires, and puncture them. So she's kind of navigating all these different places. And at first I was like, what are we doing? Oh my, like she'd fall and cry because she'd get a thorn in her hand or her foot. You know, and I thought, oh my God, was this the wrong choice? But within weeks, she was not only walking, but running. She'd get a prick and she'd pull it out. That first week was really hard because she was on a new routine. So yes, I'd probably have to stop every 20 minutes for a snack, water. And it was frustrating because in my mind I was like, okay, we're on this adventure and we're going 20 Ks a day. And I quickly had to be like, no, we're just going. This is the adventure. And to kind of take that expectation off, because if she needed to stop, we'd stop. But it was really interesting because instant gratification was a big thing that is not compatible with the outback, but is typical in modern parenting. I mean, you have entertainment in your pocket on your phone that's endless. And I think out there you don't have that. You know, it was the best thing about it was a digital detox. So we just kind of, at first she would, you know, she just had to learn to wait. If she was hungry, there was no fast food. We had some snacks. When they were gone, they were gone. You know, if we made dinner, she had to wait for a fire to be made, dinner to be cooked. And I think it taught her, she became way more capable of entertaining herself. I didn't have to entertain her as much. She could be in her cart for 2 or 3 hours by the end, which comparison to the 20 minutes in the beginning was a big change. She was also happy to kind of be a part of the team. So I noticed a big difference in her tolerance. I think it proved to me too that, you know, in today's day and age, you want to give them everything, but they don't need it right now. And it's not a bad thing to I guess, get back to basics a bit.
How did you both, and Morgan as well, adapt to the inherent, I guess, dangers of the outback of wildlife, like snakes and the unpredictability of snakes, not so much the snake just being there, but...
Snakes is one of my major concerns. I mean, there's a couple of key things in it, like snakes, dehydration, exposure, that sort of stuff. But snakes, that really worried me because Morgan's interaction with snakes, if she was to get bitten by one, it's pretty much some of the snakes out there, it's a death sentence. The inland taipan's got, you know, it's the most venomous snake in the world. Each time it bites, it pumps in enough to kill 100 grown men. So what chance would a child have? I mean, like if Lauren and I actually got bit, I actually think you could actually, you know, immobilize, keep someone calm enough, you know, put a pressure immobilization bandage on enough, long enough for help to come. With a child, they're not rational, so that you can't reason with them. So for us, it was always, one of us always had to be on her. So if she was out there playing, we'd scope out the area, check it out first, make sure that there was nothing sort of harmful in the area. Mm-hmm. And then just always be watching her. So it was kind of tough because we wanted to spend this quality time together, but we were at times just ships passing in the night because we were always doing something. Yeah. And it's only when we put Morgan to bed do we actually get some quality alone time as a couple.
Yeah. And during the day, the distance between any roadhouses, or like if you're on the highway, you see the roadhouses every couple of hundred kilometres, but out on the track you were following, was Was there anything there that you saw?
Yeah, no, so we'd probably come into some sort of civilization, whether it be a station or a small town, every couple hundred kilometres for us, with the way that we go in. And we did that deliberately because we couldn't carry enough food to go the entire journey. So what we'd do is we'd send food out, food drops out to these certain locations. And you're still talking, it was 2 weeks, sometimes 2 weeks plus between these spots for us when we were walking. So yeah, you get pretty comfortable with just being
you must have wanted to hope that you find the food drop. I mean, was there any time where you thought it's supposed to be here but it's not, and it's
I don't really
because they were in towns or
they're in towns.
There was only one that had a GPS track that we were going to find, but then our friends ended up saying, you guys are doing this amazing thing, we want to come out here, and they drove 5,000 kilometers round trip.
5,000 kilometer round trip just to say goodbye.
Just a night in the outback and to connect with them, because we have no phones. So you're like on kind of radio. You've texted from a sat phone 2 days before saying we're roughly in this vicinity. But I mean, we were going down a road and we'd only go 20K. So it wasn't too hard to find us, actually, oddly.
That was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And what about just like, you know, for Morgan? I mean, we'll be interested to see what sort of impact this experience has on her as a person later, but you won't know for a while now. But just in the short term, have you noticed anything?
Well, it's really hard. Well, actually, what do you think about that, Lauren? Because I've got a night.
Well, I mean, you don't know what she would have been if you didn't, but, you know...
We would have had to have twins and left one behind. Yeah, I think.
When we were looking, I mean, we got a lot of criticism of, are you crazy? Are you irresponsible? You know, at times we question that ourselves, but I think we knew, hey, like, kids are naturally, you know, love nature. They want to be with their parents. Like, how bad this could this be? But we looked and people were like, oh, well, she's not going to remember it because, you know, she was 16 months when we left. And I think that's fair. She might not remember it. But, you know, they say like 90% of their neurological pathways are actually created sub 2. So even if she doesn't remember it, her being in nature, and she's a city kid. But by the time we were done with our expedition, she had spent about a fourth or a fifth of her life in a tent in the outback, like in a pretty
talk about unstructured play.
Yeah. Like really wild, really touching. You know, you can't get that in today's world. You do have to go on these different, you have to seek outside the norm to find
part of her instinct now.
Yeah. I think we went back out there 6 months later because we were asked to learn how to camelier, as you do. And we went out for 10 days and she jumped straight back into the tent, getting sticks for fire. I mean, her first words were sticks, fire, emu, stars,
fly,
moon, fly.
Dingo.
It's pretty amazing. Like, she was in a pretty, she was just like a little sponge. So I can't help but think she couldn't suck it up. And when I was worried that this would hurt her in the beginning, by the end, I had no doubt that it was good for her.
There was something slightly awkward, though, about getting back. Because we live in a 2-bedroom apartment in Bondi and we've raised this sort of outdoor kid. And she would want to go to the toilet just, you know, anywhere. Actually, we're in Bondi. And she's like, it's like, you know, outdoor.
Well, she was still in diapers out there, nappies, but she'd see her parents doing bush wheeze. And so she just thought she would copy that. We had to explain. Or pick flowers, and she'd pick the neighbor's flowers. Or play in the road, because in the outback, the road was a safer place because you'd only one, maybe two cars would pass a day and you could see the big snakes.
Yeah.
Versus if they're in the shrubs, that was a bit scarier. So we're like, oh, go play on the road. Well, in Bondi, you're not going to tell them to do that. So we had a bit of correction to do when we got home.
And what about for yourselves? Physically, how was it?
I think that digital detox for me, being in that corporate world where you're always switched on more and more, also being a woman that's corporate professional and then a mom, it's all about lean in, do more. And I think I just hit that kind of, I don't know, maybe burnout combined with just what is the life I want to live and why do I want to live it? And I might need some time to kind of step back to actually create the life I want to live. And we didn't want to just be waiting for the weekend. We wanted to design a life that we didn't need a vacation from. And this was kind of, you know, parenthood pilgrimage to figure out how you do that versus just, you know, doing everything because everybody else does it. And I think I had done that my whole life, and this was a way to break out of that. So for me, that was probably the biggest gift, is to challenge normal and give myself the courage to kind of do something a bit different, because I hadn't done that before. Justin, on the other hand,
I've got to say, physically, I think you did amazingly well on the journey as well, and mentally, I should say. But to go out
mentally
there and
I struggle
not
more. Yeah. Well,
to not be, and you know, outdoorsy person in the sense that you've done a lot of camping and this or the other. Before she'd met, you'd probably, you know, glamped more than you'd camped.
Yeah.
And she went out there and knocked 102 days out there camping in a tent, you know, on a first big trip. And that's phenomenal. I mean, I know hardcore guys that would, you know, battle after about a week, just being, you know, constantly dirty, not showering, this, that, the other. Physically, she did amazingly well as well. I think that, you know, raising and growing a child inside you is actually surprisingly good training for a trip like this. I mean, we did train a lot for the journey as well. Physically, me, I battled my ankle in particular. I had a lot of ankle issues along the way. I sprained it and sort of had my arch kind of collapse in the third week of the trip and had to drag that on for the next 10 weeks, which wasn't fun. But yeah, no, it was a good experience.
But he has a weird relationship with pain. And for me, I don't get that. And so I always had to check in and say, like, are you doing long-term damage and can you trust your body? And don't, like, there's, for the first time, this trip wasn't about the end goal. It wasn't about crossing the finish line. It was about kind of these internal pursuits that we were both challenging. So his last trips were, you know, am I going to make the world record or not? You know, am I going to get that? It's your traditional achievement associated with sport or adventure. This really wasn't. Like, no one really cared. Like, there was no world medal, first, fastest, best. It was all about, can we mix parenthood and adventure? Can we create a life that's a bit different and do it on our own terms?
Can we reclaim our 30s?
Can we reclaim our 30s? Everyone says, like, oh, be wild and free, you're in your 20s. But when you're 30, you have to settle down. And we wanted to have a family, but we didn't necessarily want to settle down in that traditional sense. But we also wanted to figure out what that was for us.
It's a bit of a throwback in time as well when you think, not so long ago, even though they talk about 100 and plus years ago, but families used to move around as families with young born children and just pulling their carts. And it makes us realise, as an example of, well, one, how much society's changed in the world we live in, and really how relatively unchallenged in these sort of experiences that the human beings generally are, you know, and you've sort of tapped into that and provide an example of what people can still do.
It is pretty funny, though, because this is going to be a bit of a tangent, but we had these little VHF, UHF radios on us and have them set to scan. And so,
like, truck radio.
And on occasion, you know, people would pass us. And, like, there was one stage we had to do, I think, 20Ks on a bitumen road. And there was a bit of traffic passing us when we were going on that 20Ks. And it's like, these people would be talking about us to their convoys. Right. Like, someone tell them the gold rush is over, you know, stuff like that.
Cars,
like,
have been invented. You don't need to walk anymore.
I was like, but that's how, like, family back in the day, the gold rush days, that they got around like that.
Well, I think that there's something really connected about walking, you know, and I think we're very disconnected in today. Like, people are always on their phone or you're always rushing from thing to thing. And it was funny because people thought we were crazy for walking, and I kind of felt crazy for walking too because I'm more traditional. But I thought it was equally crazy when you'd see convoys of city people going through the outback for an adventure and they wouldn't even stop for the small things. So I think it's that you bring that back into your everyday life. And I try to kind of remember that I don't want to live my life in that rush anymore. I still want to be successful. I still want to have purpose. I still want to contribute, but I don't, that noise and the always being distracted, I think there's more to it.
Well, I'm interested to hear more about how you've maintained some of that now that you've come back from this trip, but I think we might need another song, so I don't know who's on the next one. What have we got?
This next track we've got is George Ezra with Budapest. This is actually a pretty special song for the two of us because it was our wedding song. Oh. So if we break out and start dancing...
we'll just let it happen.
My house in Budapest, my hidden treasure chest, golden grand piano, my beauty focused EOU. Ooh, you, ooh, I'd leave it all. My acres of a land I've achieved, it may be hard for you to stop and believe, but for you, ooh, you, ooh, I'd leave it all. Oh, for you, ooh, you, ooh, I'd leave it all. Give me one good reason why I should never make a change. Baby, if you owe me, then all of this will go away. My many artifacts, the list goes on. If you just say the words, I'll up and run. Oh, to you, ooh,
I divido. Over you, ooh, ooh, I divido. Give me one good reason why I should never make a change. Baby, if you want me, then all of this will go away. Give me one good reason why I should never make a change. Baby, if you want me, then all of this will go away. My friends and family, they don't understand. They fear they'll lose so much if you take my hand. But for you, ooh, you, ooh, I'd lose it all. Ooh, for you, ooh, you, ooh, I'd lose it all. Give me one good reason why I should never make a change. My hidden treasure chest, golden grand piano, my beautiful Castillo, you, ooh, you, ooh, I'd leave it all. Ooh, for you, ooh, you, ooh, I'd leave it all.
And that was Budapest by George Ezra, brought in by our guests today, Lauren and Justin Jones, who have completed an 1,800-kilometre journey across the outback, which they're close to finishing their documentary about. And they're here telling us a little bit about their adventure. And we've just been chatting about some of their experiences and transferring some of that coming back then to the city, how they've managed that transition.
Have you found it, actually, Lauren?
I mean, originally when I got back, I was worried about, you know, people like, oh, you live in Bondi. You know, when we were out in the outback, people couldn't believe we lived in Bondi. They're like, it's so busy. And it is. It's a very busy suburb. I've always liked the city. I was raised in Seattle, lived in San Francisco. I like the buzz and the vibe. So I was interested to see how I would readjust. The noise I struggled with, which there was like always competing noise. So, you know, whether it's multiple conversations or background noise or whatever, I missed some of that quiet, I guess. But for the most part, I think the biggest thing that we brought back is this desire to build a life you don't need a vacation from, and to have the courage to kind of pave your own path, even when you're supposed to be settled down and safe and responsible. You can do that. So, you know, we're working on a documentary together. Justin's had two already, but this is the first time we've worked on it. I'm writing a book, which I loved writing as a kid, but thought that wasn't the probably the safest career route. So I went into business and accounting, and now I'm kind of back to following a passion. So I think bringing that back has probably been the greatest gift that the walk has given us so far.
It was a rough transition, though. I found it a rough transition. So, like, about three to 5 months, even, was pretty. I couldn't really focus too well. You know, the crowds, noise, and just, yeah. I think there's a yearning that's coming to us for a bit of a quieter life as well since doing that trip. And I love the city. I've always lived in the city, and I've lived in big cities. I lived in Jakarta when I was young, so it's like crazy busy. And just, yeah, I wouldn't mind some more quiet in our life. And so I think we've been talking about how we can actually work that in at some point in stage. And I think before that, we probably wouldn't have had those conversations so much.
But I think it's kind of finding that quiet and conscious life no matter where you are. Like, we live in a 2-bedroom apartment. Instead of maybe stretching ourselves and spending more money on something bigger, it's like being okay with the small, like, I mean, it's pretty luxurious compared to a tent in the outback. I don't, you just kind of remind yourself of what is it that you're really chasing. So I think that those things that led us to the outback are still things that we use in our life, of finding that kind of consciousness and that connection. And
the experiences, the connections, the people you meet, the friends you make, it's just so important. Whereas not about the things. It's just not about things.
And you can get caught up in the rat race. I don't know if some people are probably better, but you compare yourself to other people, or you're in your 30s and you should be, you know, have achieved some level of financial or physical success. And I think, you know, we always have to challenge ourselves to be like, what is that for us? And we actually defined our own mission possible statement as a family. They have mission statements as you know, businesses, but you're like, well, why can't we have them as a family? So we created those.
I did see that on your website. I thought it was great. What was it? Be nice?
Live kind, live great.
Yeah.
So yeah, curious was just kind of to never stop kind of that viewing never stop looking at the world through that curious lens of a child, you know, because we can grow up and just kind of forget about that beauty. Live kind is giving back, and that, you know, that not just to take and to tread lightly. So some sustainability stuff around that, which is my background. And then live great is just define that life that's great for you and chase it, not based on others.
Did you meet any people out there who you immediately connected to and you're sort of still in contact with?
Definitely. Yeah. It was really interesting, especially the people that live out there. Mm-hmm. Initially, I think there was a bit of, like, you know, raised eyebrows, what are these people doing? And then they kind of... But they really sort of became a huge part of the journey for us, and they, to an extent, looked after us out there. So it was some of the communities, Apachula was fantastic. We sort of came into this community, and some people have, in passing to us, been slightly negative about it. It's like, oh, there's not much there, just pass through. We stayed there for 3 nights and we had a great time. Morgan was playing with these little indigenous kids, and she picked up a nickname, which was awesome, which was Maku, which meant little white witchetty grub.
Oh, really?
Kind of what she looked like. Yeah. And then we passed through some of the station country and made friends on these stations that we'll have forever. Mm. And it really sort of opened up our eyes to their lives out there. We went 12 kilometers out of our way one day so that Morgan could have a play day. Mm-hmm. And 12 kilometers is a long way when you're walking. I mean, that's half our day.
And there was a hill.
There was a huge hill as well. And there were 3 kids there, and then they got along like a house on fire. And that just opened up a whole bunch of other stuff. So we got mail deliveries actually out there. There's a mailman does this 600-kilometer mail route, and he saw us 3 times over the course of this 2 weeks. We were kind of in his area, and he was like dropping off donuts to us from the stations and fresh fruit.
We had a road train stop. He kind of honked, and we were like, oh God, what have we done? Are we too on the road? And he kind of popped out. He was a cousin of one of the stations that we stayed on, and they're like, oh, they gave us a call, you'd be down on our land sometime in the next couple weeks. And he popped out with like lunch for Morgan and like yogurt and sandwiches, and he's like, all right, see you later, and get on this huge truck and like took off. It was just so bizarre, but it was really amazing.
Yeah. Are these moments you've captured on film, or
we have.
So it's part of the documentary and the book, obviously.
It's definitely part of the documentary. It's about sort of like how the outback starts to kind of like lend us a hand out there, and you know, and there's these city slickers coming through, and it's like, oh, and we're in the middle of nowhere, and like the guys in the bush are like, no, we knew you were there. It's the Bush Telegraph, and they take care of their own and take care of the people that are traveling on their land.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, that was one thing we noticed between people who were actually from the city and people from the land. The people from the land, whether indigenous stations, whatever, they'd always make sure you're okay. You got enough water? All right, cool. Move on. It was the city folks that would come up, the window would go down, a camera would come out, they'd take some photos of you, and then the window would go back up and then move on, and then they'd stop, the window would go back down, and they'd shoot the flies out, and then they'd keep going. And you're like, okay, all right, don't say
but
hi.
But they
then.
Didn't stop enough to see what we were doing because they were on a schedule.
Yeah.
So they took the picture but went, which I thought was interesting. I mean, I've done that, you know, like.
We've all done that, and I think probably a lot of our listeners are thinking, yeah. Next time I'm going to do it differently, because that connection that you have obviously made with those people was just means so much more.
Yeah, it was just definitely within those little things, the little things that we would have missed completely if we were rushing. And I think that was one of the best things is by we kind of categorized the expedition stages. That first stage was just survival. There was nothing pretty about it. We were going outside of our comfort zone. It wasn't, you know, it was emotionally high and low. It was hard. It was, yeah, it was challenging. And then the next one's kind of like where we were adapting and getting into new routines. And by the end, we were actually, we had a new normal and we were hitting 30 kilometers a day. And it wasn't because it was, you know, easier. It was actually, we were well into spring. We were hitting 42 degree temperatures. There was less shade, but we were capable of doing so much more and we were enjoying it so much more, you know, like every sun, the moon was just amazing. I didn't really even realize there was such specific moon cycles. I mean, and I'm a woman too, you'd think that that would all connect, but like I live in the city and the moon comes up over there and you just, so then we started to get more in tune with just nature and it felt a little less scary for me because at first I was like, let's just hide in a bush and it felt scary. And by the end we felt, we definitely felt more connected, which was...
Did you avoid walking in the absolute heat of the day just to try and walk in the darkness before dawn and
so typically, early mornings? Typically, that's what, like, most explorers or, you know, people who are doing desert walks do because, you know, you get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and then you walk till, you know, 8 or 9 and you hide in the middle of the day and then you walk into the evening. With a child, that doesn't really work.
Yeah.
You know, they've got to... The only way you could do that is if you're willing to put yourself in some severe, severe, severe sleep deprivation. So, so with Morgan, she, you know, we wanted to keep her unbroken sleep as much as possible. And then during the day, it was walk time. We marched to her schedule. So it meant that, unfortunately, we were walking in the heat of the day.
We walked in the heat of the day every day because that's when she would nap. So, and also if we were in the heat of the day without shade, it wasn't good for her to be running around anyway. So walking consistently and methodically was actually one of the best ways to kind of tackle that.
You did speak briefly to me in the break about some of the sustainability issues that you had about having a child with you on the trek.
Yeah.
I was really interested to hear a bit about that, and I think it's something our listeners would probably be interested in as well.
Yeah, so I work in sustainability, and I think that, you know, when you start to do adventure stuff, you know, there's an ethos of pack it in and pack it out. You know, don't throw your waste on the trail and bring all your rubbish out with you. But I think in sustainability terms, I have it in my head of like, there is no away when you throw it. We are on one planet and it goes somewhere and it's quickly hitting capacity. Like there's going to be more plastic than fish in the ocean by 2030. And I think that's a very conservative estimate. So we just started to say, well, if we love nature and we want to be in it and we're thriving and we're craving it, we want to protect it. So we really looked at everything that we packed and how we packed it and tried to get rid of single-use plastic and to have a zero waste expedition or adventure. And it happened that Morgan was still in nappies, so we had to figure out nappies. Well, there wasn't any fully compostable nappies readily on the market. So we ended up partnering with a company called G Diapers, and they had a product called G Cycle, and it's the first fully compostable disposable nappy. And so we trialed that. It has like a band. I have a lot of info on our website if you want to put it up. There's the website's thejonesys.com. So www.thejonesys.com. But there's an article called What to Do About Poo. And it was, you know, if you want to adventure sustainably with a kid, there's some options. So yeah, happy to field any of those. But it was great because we could actually, we didn't have to pack it in or pack it out. We could compost them or burn them without any petrochemicals because they had no plastics.
Worst thing about it though was that, you know, Morgan had soiled these nappies or diapers along the way in the day, and we're not going to just stop and burn them. So what would they do? That they get put onto my cart, and so my cart forever got called the poo train. So Morgan would be like, poo train, and I'm like, thanks, Morgan.
And Justin would come and he'd have this like herd of flies coming
behind me, and I was just like, this is great.
Yeah, I don't think many people would be that keen on that, but
yeah. Tailwinds weren't good.
What was actually the weather like on the trip? And then I'm also interested about the geography and how much it changed while you were...
We had a pretty big variation in temperature. So I think at the start of the trip, you know, we were coming in, well, still in winter, but it was coldest I think we had was about -2 overnight, and then the hottest we had over the course of the journey was 42 degrees, and that started getting fairly consistent towards the back end. The first week of the trip was temperature-wise was actually pretty good. It was really, really good, and I think that was very...
We were just not good.
Yeah, we weren't good. we were struggling with the whole just trying to find a system, how to work, the routine. And then when we entered cattle country, we got slammed by flies. And like, I mean, slammed by flies. You'd eat, you know, how many in a day? And Morgan, you know, would have her food and there'd just be flies kind of crawling around her eyes and crawling into her food. And you just can't do much about it. And that's because you're entering into cattle country. There's so much more manure around the ground, and so many more flies.
But it was interesting, after a couple of days, you did get used to it. I don't know if the flies got a bit better, but I mean, it just the first 3 days when we entered, I remember it felt overwhelming, and then you just kind of they're really not a big deal.
Yeah, that's true. And the terrain did change. I mean, the start was kind of fairly dense, sort of scrub kind of around us, and a lot of mole scrub, certain types. You'd have those monolithics, you know,
indigenous
formations.
Land.
And then you sort of come all the way down to these gibber plains where there's just like basically sun-baked round rocks and these plains of it. It looks like you're on Mars. There's not a tree around you. And then you come down to some of the waterhole countries where, well, we only saw two waterholes, but they were phenomenal. There's this like kilometre-long, 50-metre-wide waterhole where we'd get into and it'd just be like paradise for us.
And these were like ancient indigenous waterholes, but then they're also now on cattle land because that's what the cattle drovers went to, was some of the water. So it was just an interesting how both of those cultures interacted as well, from a city perspective.
And the Flinders Ranges, that's just stunning.
Yeah, the Flinders Range. I mean, just, and I think, yeah, it, once again, if you were in a car, there were changes, but I think you could, you know, blink and miss them. But when you were walking, like every small change became significant. So that was...
And the wildlife.
Yeah, the wildlife was pretty amazing. Epic. I mean, there's wild camels.
Brumbies. Everything.
Brumbies would... We had a Brumby that walked with us for a couple, like 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
Just woke up looking in our tent, came out. We were like, oh, my God. And I think he had a herd. I'm not sure. We talked to, like, some horse experts, but he just was really curious. We thought maybe he wanted to mate with Justin because Justin looked like one of those, like, human...
With the cart.
Like...
Can you imagine if that happened?
Human, like, horse animals. What are those things called?
A centaur.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like this... I get mounted by this horse and all of a sudden I'm just dangling in the air.
So we thought he had a crush on Justin for a while, but anyways... But he walked with us for a couple hours.
He was quite beautiful. Intimidating. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. Well, when it came time to end the trip, like, what were you feeling?
Definitely mixed emotions. Like, you know, that had become our new normal. So a big piece of us didn't want it to end, but at the same time, we knew that it needed to.
I was a broken man. My ankle was screaming out for some sort of like rest and recoup. So
yeah,
it was interesting. Like, marching into Port Augusta was like, it's phenomenal to achieve this journey. But it was a bit of an anticlimax in some regards, because, you know, this journey wasn't about trying to set a record. It wasn't about the end or what the achievement was. It was about proving to ourselves that we could live a certain way and just do something different. And so coming back from that, you know, it's about the rest of our life now. That end was just the start of how we want to live. I mean, because you can't really compare, I suppose, coming into Port Augusta and jumping into the water and to, like, on the Tasman, having 25,000 people come down at a beach to see you in, or... What actually happened down in Antarctica, which is another story in itself. But it has been the opening to the rest of our lives. And I think it's going to be fun also to see Morgan be the girl that she's going to grow up to be. And we wanted to raise a strong, curious, brave, you know, just out there girl. And I think, I don't know, I think she's on that path.
She may one day say, Dad, I had a premonition about going on this outback trip. It could be just a vague memory, but she doesn't realize it's a memory, but she has this vision.
I think every time a fly just flies into her mouth, she'll just go, the outback.
Yeah.
This reminds me of something.
What about for you know, people who are listening to you today and elsewhere, what would be your advice to them if they get inspired to want to seek or experience the same sort of adventure?
Let's give them a piece of advice, H. What would you say?
Just listen to that little, like, if you're feeling angsty or you're feeling closed in or you're feeling like you want something more, I think don't just push that down, because I think the scariest thing is when your job is good enough or your life is good enough, you know, like it's scary to kind of let that go for this thing that you want to chase. I think don't let good stand in the way of great, mm-hmm. and don't kind of let that complacency set in so that then you tune out that little voice, because I think following that little voice is both interesting, worthwhile, and possible.
I think societal expectations are a funny thing, that you do feel a lot of pressure, especially when you have a kid, to settle down. You know, you can't rock the boat, and you've got to stick to the party line and do what everyone else does,
or you're
and
really
get all the things, or you are irresponsible. And to buddy, just challenge normal a little bit, to like go out there. I mean, kids, the biggest lesson I think I learned was from Morgan, and it's that every day what she was doing was just normal for her. Mm. You know, it was, you know, playing up, engaging, connecting, doing things. That is just normal.
So and she what didn't you're have doing... preconceived notions of what's normal. The outback wasn't weird for her. Like, everything's new. So everything was equally as new as being in the city.
So if we could all just like take a little bit of that, I think that'll be pretty amazing, because I think it'll be a nicer society for people to deal with, actually.
And I think that's just living life through that, you know, with that curious lens of a child. Like, they don't have preconceptions of what's right or wrong or normal or not. They just enjoy the moment. And I think, yeah, trying to do that more is something we've been working on.
Sounds like a good bit of advice, you know. You don't have to necessarily trek out to the middle of the outback to sort of absorb
that
either.
It's not for everyone.
You know, I mean, adventure is always something different. You know, whatever one person's adventure is not necessarily another person's adventure, but in the spirit of the philosophy of what you're talking about, it's
defining whatever that is for you.
What you want to do, that gut instinct.
Yeah. We've really appreciated our time here today.
Great. Well, I've been so interested in everything that you've had to say, and I hope our listeners have as well. I'm looking forward to seeing the documentary when it finally comes
out. Well, make sure we send you a copy. We're like a couple of weeks off, I think, of it being completed. So, jump onto our website, our social media,
reach
that sort
out
of thing.
Say hi.
Yeah, that'd be really cool.
Awesome.
Will the book and the video come out at the same time? Or
no, the book is a journey in itself. Okay. It's about half written, almost. So hopefully by the end of this year, it should come out. Yeah.
Great. And we are going to, if you've got one more song for us.
Yep. So this was one of the first songs that I fell in love with when I moved to Australia 11 years ago, and it's the Temper Trap Sweet Disposition.
Lovely.
Saw them at a small little venue.
And you've been listening to Crossing the Line here on Eastside Radio 89.7, and our guests in the studio today have been Lauren and Justin Jones. The Jonesies.com is their website. You can look there up there, follow their adventures. And if you want to get in touch with Crossing the Line, you can reach us on crossingtheline@eastsidefm.org or on Twitter @crossingtheline_sport. And stick around, because Drive is coming up next, and we're going to go out with their final choice of music, which is the Temper Trap. See you guys next week.